Eyes not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning to Song of Solomon chapter 2. We'll have a bit of a disclaimer this morning, for we are going to review briefly verses 2 through 5 to set up verse 6. We've been noting Solomon's pickup lines. Verse 2 contains number 5. Like a lily among the thorns, so is my love among the virgins. And to this, the Shulamite responds with an aria. It will take her commentary all the way down to the end of the first act. That will occur at Song of Solomon 3:5. She begins in verse 3, like an apple tree among the trees of the grove, so is my beloved among the young men. She has been isolated by Solomon as a lily among the thorns. So is my love, and my love makes reference to the Shulamite. This is unnerving, to have the king of Israel refer to her as my love. He's identified her now as someone he's going to incorporate not only into his harem, but he now is signifying that he believes that she is his right woman and that she is a lily among the thorns, because the thorns are then identified as the virgins who are standing in the corner. So she turns the tables on him and says, well, like an apple tree among the trees of the grove, so is my beloved. And her beloved, therefore, becomes the ultimate apple tree, and the rest are just scrubs and saplings by comparison, and that includes Solomon. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Verse 4. He brought me to the banquet house, and his banner over me was love. This is a social engagement. They go to a type of restaurant that would serve wine. They probably toasted. He no doubt on that occasion proposed to her in the fashion that was common in that day. And in essence, he planted his banner of love in her soul. He identified her as his right woman and indicated that he desired to marry her. We studied that in a bit of detail by noting the significance of the banner. Then in verse 5, she says, sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples because I am lovesick. Now, this lovesickness is brought on as a psychosomatic type of illness. It is temporary, of course. She is revived by these restoratives that we see in verse 5. But she is staggered mentally by the insinuation of Solomon that she is his right woman, that he intends to incorporate her into his harem. And at the same time, she remembers back that she is not free to do this, for she is now espoused to the shepherd. And she remembers back when they went on this social occasion and how he proposed to her and how she now has been identified by him as her right woman, and she has responded to him likewise. She believes he is her right man. And therefore, the combination of these two things, the absence of the shepherd who she loves, the presence of the king who she doesn't really care for, has caused her to become weakened, low blood pressure, and therefore she has a combination of these things called fainting and lovesickness. Now, lovesickness is kala ahava, to be sick with love. And we find the Shulamite, therefore, the victim of a psychosomatic disorder brought on by this combination of events. We examined the psychosomatic disorder in our studies on Thursday evening. We went through the combination of having a physiological reaction as well as a psychological reaction. And these things come together to cause her to faint. And as a result of this, the restoratives are administered. Now, this psychosomatic disorder, again, is called love sickness, for which she needs these restoratives. She's given nourishment from the virgins with raisin cakes, and then the restorative aroma of a sliced apple to bring her back to her senses. And thus revived, she continues her aria by looking forward to the time when she is married to the shepherd, and she imagines the time when they can allow their passions and desires to be fully expressed. This is in Song of Solomon 2:6, "His left hand was under my head, and his right hand embraces me." Now, this is the New American Standard Bible's translation, and it doesn't convey the right tense and therefore the right context for the verse. The verb that's of importance is embrace, and the tense that is selected by the New American Standard translators makes it appear that this is a current ongoing event. Now, the Shulamite and Shepherd are not married. They are only engaged, as she has related to us in the earlier verses. It is in opposition, therefore, to divine standards for a man and a woman, even if right for each other, to engage in sexual acts prior to marriage. Now, here is where I want to give you sort of a disclaimer. My intent in this study is to instruct parents as well as young people. The subject matter that we are discussing here is one of the major areas, I believe, of child abuse in this country. And this child abuse is imposed upon young people beginning at extreme early ages, way before the proper ages, in my view, that it should be addressed. Probably around the age of 11 or 12 or 13, that neck of the woods is where they should be discussed initially. Up till then, children should be allowed to be children. Up till then, children shouldn't have such weighty matters going on in their souls. They need to be isolated from that. And they are prevented from having a normal childhood by the imposition of the tactics and the techniques of sexual activity in sex education classes. And I believe this is horrific. And in my way of thinking, the way to combat that is to take a look at this entire issue from the divine viewpoint. And I've tried to, first of all, introduce you to the subject matter of the soul and how soul rapport is the initial imperative for any type of relationship that ultimately would lead to marriage, and that the physical aspects of it are things that are delayed much later until after the wedding. And the anticipation of this, however, is something that is normal. And we would be fooling ourselves if we didn't admit to this. And so once young people begin to identify others as potential mates and ultimately to finally recognize they've found their right person, then they begin to contemplate matrimony and what would happen after that. You know, they visualize a home and then ultimately children and then this, that, and the other things that would go on over the course of a lifetime. And people are free to imagine these things. And everyone imagines there's going to be a wonderful family life. There will be children who will go to Harvard. There will be daughters who will go to where? I don't know, Vassar. And they will come out and they'll be glowing representatives of the family line. And that they will live happily ever after and all things will be wonderful. But what's wrong with that? Now, there's nothing wrong with it. That is the imagination working. These are hopes that people have for their futures. And these are the kinds of things that become encouragements for individuals as they move into the very serious institution of marriage. You need to be encouraged, and this encouragement can come from within, and it can be based on the Word of God. You desire that your family is a loving family, that everyone is positive to the Word of God, that all the children become saved, that they advance and find their own right people, right men or right women as the case might be, and that they would rear children in a Christian household and infuse into their souls the power of the Word of God and its doctrines. These are things that are legitimate to imagine, and oftentimes it can even border into fantasy. And I submit to you that this is a good thing, and it contributes to the ability of young people to fall under the aegis of the Word of God, to remain honorable during a dating and preferably courtship period, but without moving outside of the parameters that are drawn in Scripture. And so one of the ways that you can manage the passions and desires is through imagination. And you therefore are as legitimate in imagining a sexual relationship with your right person in marriage as you are in looking forward to a happy family life, because the two go together. And therefore, imagination and fantasy are legitimate. They are a part of maintaining the mental attitude of what we should say, the mental attitude of abstinence. For you can go into your mind's eye, loving the person you've identified, and imagine the ultimate relationship that you can express with regard to soul rapport. And so this is where we're embarking right now in verse 6. And I felt like I had to clear the decks for that as we move along. Here's the Shulamite recovering from a bout with a love sickness. And it is caused, the love sickness is caused by unfulfilled passions and desires for her shepherd. And these passions and desires for the person God has chosen for you are legitimate. She was shocked by Solomon's repeated reference to her as my love. It is right for her to be repulsed by that idea. He's not her right man. She does not love him and does not care to be loved by him. And this caused her to shift in her thinking over to her own true love. I don't want to think about you, Solomon. I want to think about the shepherd. Solomon's idea is to get her in bed. You do understand that, don't you? She does not have a desire to do that. If she is going to do such a thing, her desire is to do that with her shepherd. And she is not allowed to do either right now. Therefore, her mental attitude shifts over to an imagination. She immediately began to think of how she truly responds to the shepherd, referring to her as my love. He obviously has done that. We've seen it in the previous verses. He says that I have planted my banner of love over you. He now has infused himself into her memory center. He is the one to whom she responds, and likewise him to her. And therefore, when he says my love, she responds to that. And thus, on this occasion, she grows faint. And upon being revived, she expresses her desire to submit to the shepherd were it possible. Oh, that I could submit to the shepherd. Oh, that I don't have to submit to Solomon. So it is her way of rejecting the idea of having sex with him. Repulsed by the thought, she now expresses her devotion to the shepherd and her willingness to submit sexually to him and to him alone. Now the verse needs a very little bit of exegesis except for the tense of the verb embrace. It is the PAL imperfect of havak, but the function of the imperfect form may be classified in several ways. So you have this verb havak. And in the English it's transliterated like this, H-A-V-A-Q, havak. And it is a PAL stem. And it is in the imperfect form. But the imperfect in the PAL can take on several forms, several classifications. And so we turn to the Net Bible footnote 7, the translator's note under Song of Songs chapter 2 verse 6. And if you have one of these, you'll find it on page 1199 and following. Now, what is noted is the Hebrew word embraces. It is havak. It is in the PL stem and in the imperfect form. Now, there are several ways that the imperfect form can be classified. In fact, there are six. Number one is the ingressive imperfect. Translated, his right hand is beginning to stimulate me. Secondly, the instantaneous imperfect. His right hand is stimulating me right now. Number three, the progressive imperfect. His right hand stimulates me. Number four, the imperfect of desire. May His right hand stimulate me. And the injunction imperfect, let His right hand stimulate me. Or finally, six, the imperfect of permission, His right hand may stimulate me. And based upon their view that the couple is not yet married, Glickman and Deere argue for an imperfect of desire, may His right hand stimulate me. Now this is an imagination going into the marriage relationship and into the marital bed. This is an expression of how the Shulamite yearns for the moment that she can give herself sexually to the shepherd. However, she is not at all influenced by the attempts of the daughters of Jerusalem to stimulate her affections and direct them towards Solomon. This is what they've been trying to do since they went out on their mission to lure her into Solomon's tent and therefore give him the opportunity to propagandize her through pickup lines into his harem. Now, he is trying to be nice to her. He's trying to be nice to her in a way that makes her assume that he is a gentleman, makes her assume that he is a fine guy and means her no harm. This is nothing but a facade. We probably won't get there today, but I want you to remember back on the several verses that we've seen involving Solomon. These several verses that we've noted, five pickup lines thus far. And when we get there, we will reference back to those briefly just to remind you of them. And when we do, you'll see that Solomon hopes to come off as a gentleman, but underneath we understand it is just a facade. Now, there are young men today who are very good at saying the right things to the young ladies. They can appear to be courteous. They can appear to have great care and compassion for them. They treat them very nicely while firing their pickup lines. You can catch more flies with honey, I guess, than you can with a gun, however that goes. But nevertheless, they lay out the honey. And they hope to attract the ladies that way by appearing to be gentlemen. But in their souls, they are conniving, and in their souls, they're nothing more than latter-day King Solomon. Therefore, we'll note the true gentlemen as well as the true ladies in our future studies, and that's coming up soon. You already got it. Don't look ahead. By the way, speak of boring. When we get to that, it's going to be extremely boring. You know, talking about gentlemen and ladies and all in 21st century America. Nobody, who wants to hear that? You get to. And just a preview to pique your boredom. I am going to quote to you from a book that was copyrighted in 1905. Back when people knew what gentlemen and ladies were. And we're not confused by all that we have to battle today in keeping our children's souls relatively pure. It is an ongoing battle. For once they walk out of the house, the media of every description bombard them. Their friends, who are really little walking perverts, bombard them. The sex ed teachers bombard them. And therefore, oftentimes, the parents do. Or they are incapable of putting up a front in order to defend them. It's quite a battle. So we have here the Shulamite having this imagination about a wedding night with the shepherd. That's where she desires to be. She doesn't want to be in Solomon's tent. She wants to be in bed with her husband. Yet we have these virgins trying to influence her to come on over to their side. So we see in Song of Solomon 2:7, as the Shulamite continues, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. Now, the commentators get very confused about this because of the feminine pronoun she. Do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. Well, it's simply saying that her love is feminine and therefore is responsive. And don't arouse my responsive nature until it is time. That is what she's saying here. And you should be careful that you don't do that to children. They have enough trouble managing their passions and desires as it is, and therefore they shouldn't be encouraged. God knows we don't need to encourage that any more than they already are capable of encouraging themselves. But you see, the media do this. They are very adept at presenting these subjects in such a way that is very pleasing to the youthful mind, and therefore the ladies especially are responsive to this. And one of the examples is chick flicks. People think chick flicks are just absolutely benign. They are not. If you're a young person and you've got romance on your mind. Do you have doctrine is the issue? That's where we're going with this. How do you manage this? Do you send your child into a federal school with no doctrine, and then they're confronted with all of this how-to information? Yeah, here's how-to, point one. And you give 10 points and say, okay, we'll have a test. And then bring out the visual aids to boot. Then they go home. And there's absolutely no mention legally. You can't mention anything legally about the soul. Can't mention anything legally about biblical viewpoints on the concept of marriage and how it all comes about. That's illegal. So they not only can they only teach half the subject, they teach the second half first. If you teach the second half first, nobody finds about it the first half. Then you've got a person who has a distorted idea of the whole thing. So I'm trying to fix that best I can. I'm really trying to be careful here. But I can't help what's in here. I got to teach what's here. Now, some things I can ignore, and I assure you I've ignored a couple of things so far, but I haven't slacked off on the things I've taught you. And there's more to come. At this point, the Shulamite issues an oath to be sworn to by the virgins, and she brings in gazelles and hinds for witnesses. Anybody know here what a gazelle and a hind is? They're zoo creatures. Well, the gazelle is a zoo creature here. The hinds are in town and country. Point two. These are members of the bovine and deer families that roamed the area in the 10th century B.C. The gazelles are male bovines, the masculine plural of Savi. There are around 15 different types found in Israel. The hinds are females, the feminine plural of Ayalah, a female deer. And the males, by the way, we'll see males pop up later. They're referred to as hinds, hearts. The females are hinds, the males are hearts. Together they're called deer. So the next time you're out hunting and you see something with big antlers, that's a hart. And if you see the doe, I don't think you can kill does except at certain points of the year, what I know about this. But as far as I'm concerned, if I were to go hunting, they said, let's go deer hunting. I said, sure, give me a gun. And so we'd go. And we'd go out there and I would see some. I've seen deer, so I know what one looks like. So if one were to run across and I would think that we're deer hunting, I would do my best to deck him. But there are rules. It's just like in baseball and football, there are rules for hunting. And you break the rules, you pay. And not being able to tell the difference, I'd deck what I saw first. And if it was a doe, and it was the time you can't shoot does, then somebody throws a flag, and you got a big problem financially. But the does, these are hinds. So if you shoot a doe, you've shot a hind. If you shoot a hart, you've shot a stag. No extra charge for that. But you need to understand these terms because these are the words they use. They're English words, but these are the words they use in the context here for these deer. Now, four. These animals, let's describe them. They were beautiful, fast, and graceful, and thus displayed the attributes of youth that speak of virility, but with mannerisms that suggest sensitivity and gentleness. The mannerisms of deer. Bovines. The gazelles are bovine, whereas the deer are deer. I've looked all of this up. I've got a word here for you. We'll get to it in a minute. It's artiodactyla. That is like the overall deal. I'm not much into this. This is where evolution comes in, and I really haven't paid much attention to this. But this A word here is the whole family, and then underneath you have the various categories, and you have bovines and you have deer. And so we have two categories here, but they all come from the same family. Now these animals were beautiful in the fast, and they were very graceful. Okay, this is the attitude that a woman has about her right man. Now, it doesn't matter what he looks like physically. The woman thinks her right man is beautiful. Handsome would be the better word. But I guess if you look at a gazelle or a deer loping across the meadow, you think beautiful. And also you have the concept of very fast. They're very fast but graceful. Thus display attributes of youth that speak of virility. And in the ancient world, those of the, let's call it the deer population, were considered to be symbols of virility. But they have mannerisms, we'll note them now, mannerisms that suggest sensitivity and gentleness. Now, as with all animals, gazelles and deer have mating seasons, but most males are not overly aggressive at the expense of the female. Some of the mating habits of these animals are included in the article on Artiodactyla, the mammalian order that includes gazelles and deer. And we find this in the Encyclopedia Britannica Micropedia's article on the Artiodactyla and their reproduction. Okay, now there's your reference if you want to follow it up. Here's what it says. In the mating ceremonies of antelopes, the male follows the female, nuzzling her neck several times. There's a neck nuzzling going on. See, this is being sensitive and gentle in the deer population. Now don't be shocked. I didn't bring up the gazelles and the deer, okay? We got to deal with the gazelles and the deer. What's the reason for this? I've got to find you the reason. Why is she mentioned, and why are they witnesses? In Thompson's gazelle, the male runs close behind the female and finally taps her hind leg with his foreleg. Any of you have gone out watching deer, maybe you see some of these mannerisms. This is courting it for deer. I mean, not for people, but for deer. Now, similar leg contact also occurs in some other antelopes. Antelope and gazelle from the same family. Another pattern occurs in the normally solitary Indian hog deer. As many as 20 or 30 aggregate loosely in a certain area. Then, females and males leave in pairs and usually remain together until they have mated. So that's monogamy. So they're very sensitive, very gentle, and then they sort of aggregate in sort of a public meeting, and then they pair off, the animals do. And that they're monogamous. And that they stay with each other until the mating season is over. So 6. As you could probably guess, there is controversy as to why Solomon quoted this comment by the Shulamite in his song. And it is obvious that she is trying to use the gazelles and deer as illustrations of how courtship should occur between men and women. These are some illustrations. So 7, these members of the bovine and deer families have characteristics that suggest from the animal kingdom some of the principles of right man, right woman. And the gazelle gently pursues the doe but waits for her positive response. The deer then pair off and remain with each other until after the birth of the fawn. Gives the illustration of how things are supposed to work. And she's brought in these gazelle and deer as witnesses to the virgins who are trying to inspire her to turn her affections to Solomon when she has already given her heart and soul to the shepherd. And she said, look, let's bring in the deer and the gazelles as witnesses to this thing. I don't want to do this thing that you're suggesting. I won't want to give my love to anyone until my love pleases. In other words, until it's the right time. just as you would have a process with the gazelles and the deer, so I have a process. You know, I've had my hind leg tapped by the front leg of the shepherd at that restaurant when we were sitting over a glass of good wine. And he proposed to me by plunging his standard into my soul and claiming me as his right woman. Yet, we still have not consummated this. We have agreed that our souls are united, but there is a process and procedure that has to be followed, and we intend to do that. Now take a look at the gazelles and the deer. After they go through their courtship, and after suddenly you have one of these does respond positively to one of the stags, then they pair off individually, monogamously, and then they go somewhere and they have sex and they have a fawn. Likewise, from their illustration, from the animal kingdom, I would suggest to you that I have a system that is far superior, but is suggested by these animals. Now, I am not... See, these animals single off one male, one female. And now you've got me in a dilemma about me becoming involved in a harem as a virgin with virgin promotable, so that at some point Solomon is going to sexually become involved with me. And I cannot deny this because he's the king of Israel. Yet my affections are steered toward my shepherd to whom I have committed my soul and to whom I am willing to commit my body at the proper time. So she in essence is dressing down these virgins for all of the work and effort they're doing on behalf of Solomon. So to repeat 7. These members of the bovine and deer families have characteristics that suggest from the animal kingdom some of the principles of right man, right woman. The gazelle gently pursues the doe but waits for her positive response. The deer pair off and remain with each other until after the birth of the fawn. Now the message the Shulamite is sending to the virgins is witnessed by these animals. The daughters should not try to stimulate her love for Solomon since she is committed to the shepherd. And she will not fully commit even to him until her love pleases. In other words, that's idiomatic for until it is the proper time. Point 9. From this we see the importance of the woman's free will in the right man, right woman relationship. This is why there is a tradition for the man to ask the woman if she would consent to marry him. Traditions go back a long, long way. And you will find that traditions are based oftentimes in religion. And this one obviously is based in biblical theology. The woman has free will. And she is the one who gives permission for marriage. The man asks the woman, "May I marry you? May I take your hand in marriage?" And she has veto power. She can say, "Well, you know, Fred, I've thought this through, and although you're very handsome, and although we've had many good times together, I've come to the conclusion that all you're in this for is the sex. And I'm in it for soul rapport first, and I've observed these things into you over the last several times we've dated. And so, no, I don't want to marry you. I need someone with whom I can have soul rapport. And I've discovered that I cannot accomplish that with you." And he would say, "Well, I'm sorry you see it that way." And then he would say, "Please, have a good day." That would be if he was a gentleman, which obviously in my description he would not be, but let's pretend. We're now fantasizing. So, but on the other occasion, if he were to come forward and ask this woman for her hand in marriage, and she would say, "You know, I've been associating with you in courtship over the last several, how long, and I have come to realize that we definitely have a rapport of soul. We seem to be right for each other. I am convinced that you are my right man, and I believe you're saying here tonight that I am your right woman. And I am thrilled absolutely to death with the idea of marrying you. And yes, yes, beloved, I say yes, let's get married. You see that? But where does it begin? It begins with the man coming to the woman, respecting her free will. Will you marry me? And the question implies she gets to say yea or nay. And that's very important. Now, it is because men do not respect the free will of the woman that so many problems are created in marriage. Look, Bible doctrine is very clear that there is an organized structure to everything. Who runs the show? The God of this universe runs the show. And with regard to the human species, He has delegated authority in many, many different ways. And you can see that there's establishment authority that's outlined in Romans chapter 13. You can see some of it in the Royal Family Honor Code in Romans chapter 12. And you can see it mentioned periodically throughout the New Testament as well as the Old. That there is authority, there is order, there is system. Someone has to take responsibility. Someone has to be held accountable. And therefore, when you see that there's a structure of order set up by God for human government, then that means that whoever comes into power in any political arena, be it local, county, state, or nation, those individuals come to power under the permissive will of God. And it is permissive. His directive will to Israel was that he would be their leader, that he would be the one who would be their protector and provider. And they said, oh, no, no, we want to have kings like the other countries do. And he said, well, okay, but know this. And then he gave a big outline of some of the foibles of becoming involved in human government. But this is what you want, here's what you get, and he gave them Saul. That was permissive will. And then after that, you have, in essence for Israel, you have directive will in the sense that the line of Christ has to be preserved, and so it is the line of David that is decreed to sit on the throne of Israel, and all the way down to the final one, and ultimately with the ultimate one, Jesus Christ. But with the Gentiles, it's all permissive will, but God says, okay, you want human government, you got human government. Therefore, whoever I permit to be in office, that's the one to whom you must submit. If you don't like it, then you structure a system that properly removes them, but no sedition and no rebellion. Properly remove. Now, that's why we have votes. All right, you see that system. Now, there are other systems that the Bible clearly reveals a system of order and authority, one of which is the family. And the family is going to be headed up by the husband. But what does that mean? Does that mean that the husband has carte blanche authority over the woman and she has no say-so in anything and her volition is therefore neutralized and canceled? It does not. So now that I've got you excited about that, at least you ladies are, this is where we will stop and have tea and crumpets, and we'll come back and note some of these things in the second session.